Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
Berkeley Grok Science Show.
That's right. It's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives. I'm Charles Lee.
Coming up on today's show, antifreeze, mooning, and hunger.
In addition, we'll be joined by Mr. Leander Connie, who will discuss the cult of the iPod.
Also, we'll find out what the DeBroy wavelength is.
So stay tuned for all of this, plus the Grokatron 5000 and the world-famous Question of the Week, coming right up here on the Berkeley Grok Science Show.
I'm Frank Ling.
And I guess that makes me Charles Lee. How you doing, Frank?
Pretty good. Where are we in the year now?
It's hard to say because the new year rolls around and what are you going to do? It's like a brand new start.
Brand new start.
And I hope a brand new start will come around next week because I'm already screwing this year up.
Have you woken up from your hibernation?
Not quite yet. I think my metabolism is still on low burn.
So you must have that antifreeze protein in you, huh?
Pretty much kept me surviving through the winter, yeah.
Oh, it turns
as,
out...
as has the blubber.
So it turns out that in a lot of extremophiles, they have certain proteins that act as an antifreeze and prevents entire animals from freezing, even though the temperature has actually gone below the 0 degrees of water. And they've actually, for the first time, been able to identify a particular protein in the particular species of snow fleas.
I would imagine it'd be pretty easy to freeze a snow flea, but...
But it can come back alive once you thaw it.
Pretty cool.
They were able to identify this particular protein because when you try to purify it and you do it in an icy solution, the proteins bind to the ice and become part of the matrix while the others are not into the ice.
So it prevents like the crystallization effect that could disrupt cellular tissues, I imagine.
For this particular purification process, it's sort of separation. So it's embedded in the solid matrix while the other proteins are washed away in the solution. But the great thing about this particular protein is that once you heat it up, it breaks apart, which means if you use it for human organ transplant... Mm-hmm. And put your new organ into another body, once you heat it up, the proteins will just go away. You don't have to worry about the post-infectious effects or antibodies forming because of that.
Oh, yeah, wow. Presumably, then, this is the application that people are trying to use it for.
Right, cryo-freeze your body, I guess.
Body tissues, yeah.
And the interesting thing is this particular protein has lots of glycine. And glycine has the same structure to what's found in glycol,
right.
One of the main ingredients in antifreeze.
Antifreeze, okay. That makes sense.
This was carried out by the California Institutes for Health Research, and it was published in Science.
So, how do you get your oxygen?
Mostly from the air.
You don't get it out of minerals in the rocks in the earth?
I don't think so. I mean, I try to electrolyze the water in myself and split the water and hydrogen and oxygen, but it doesn't quite work so well.
It's kind of difficult, I think. Running a few volts through yourself usually isn't very good, generally.
I used to cheat, but mine's kind of weak, you know.
Perhaps on the moon.
On the moon?
That's what NASA's trying to do. They're actually trying to extract oxygen from a mineral that's on the moon called illimite.
So, is this some scheme to form an atmosphere on the moon by releasing oxygen from its minerals?
Well, maybe not a complete atmosphere, but at least to support a colony of humans that would use the moon as a station for interstellar space travel.
You know, I saw Star Trek, too. Didn't they have the Genesis device or something?
Yeah, that doesn't really work so well, because Khan usually gets a hold of it and tries to blow up Kirk, so... pretty difficult. But this is actually part of NASA's greater aim. Their actually recent study used the Hubble Space Telescope to try and peer onto various craters on the moon. Mm-hmm. And what they've done is they actually studied the Aristarchus crater, which actually allows them to actually peer pretty deeply in because this is a very deep impact crater. Uh-huh. And they're actually just analyzing the composition of the minerals deep in the moon's surface. So the finding is, hopefully, if they have a lot of this ilmenite mm-hmm. and they can extract a lot of oxygen from it, then it's quite promising as a means for producing oxygen on the moon.
Wow.
So fascinating stuff. And if anyone is actually interested in this, they can take a look. It's reported on the NASA press release.
So how do you control your fluids, Charles?
Combination of osmosis and the kidneys.
And a little gravity, probably.
Yeah, I stand on my heads if it starts leaking out too quickly.
So it turns out you may actually be able to do this using electrical fields.
Well, I guess that makes sense, since at least the urine content has some
kind of ionic
character, yeah.
Analytical chemists have been using this phenomena for capillary electrophoresis, where they actually have a solution of charged molecules dissolved in it, and then by running an electrical field across the column, they can accelerate these particles to go from one end to the other. So basically a separation mechanism
Right. Based
on the charge to mass ratio. By doing that, you can drive the actual fluid flow to this column, and it's envisioned that you can actually create entire devices of valves by changing the voltage across the column.
So an electric field valve.
Yeah, indeed.
Wow.
And not one valve, but a series of them, and create basically a microcircuit to do massively parallel experiments where you'd be able to pump, for example, different type of amino acid into each chamber and do it combinatorial many, many, many times.
Okay. What's the matter with, like, a conventional valve? It's not usable at that scale, I imagine.
Well, conventional valves require moving parts, and they eventually break down. But if you can do it all electronically, then that's much more efficient, and you can do some cool DNA experiments very, very fast and cheaply.
Wow, okay. I'll look forward to that then.
Yeah.
Because I'm tired of turning valves.
So this is interesting work carried out by Peidong Yang here at the Department of Chemistry, along with Arun Majumdar in the Mechanical Engineering Department.
Oh, very cool. All right, and finally, Frank, are you hungry?
My hunger consumes me.
So do you eat a lot then?
I guess so, but one day my stomach will just eat me, like sea urchins do that.
Yeah, well, there's that story of the organism that basically, once it finds a rock to cling onto, it eats its own brain and just starts filter feeding.
It still stays alive without the brain?
Yeah, it doesn't need it because it can just start filter feeding at that point from the stuff that flows off the rock or in the sea by it.
Oh, okay.
And the analogy is that that's quite a lot like a professor after tenure. The main point here, we always get off on these tangents somehow. The main point here is that eating can kill you.
Eating can kill you. Well, I know obesity can kill a lot of people.
Well, that's true. But there's sort of been this link for quite some time between calorie restriction and longevity.
Uh-huh.
Question is, though, whether or not it's just calorie restriction or there's some other mechanism involved that's actually creating the longevity from eating fewer calories.
I thought we're actually adapted to not eat very much, and so the body's actually in a constant state of stress, which actually makes us stronger, but because we're always well-fed, we lose that state of being alert, and so by attrition, we just age faster.
Another theory is that there's sort of oxidative damage that comes about just from the breaking down of all these materials.
Especially sugars, right?
Right. But it's not really known. So people have actually started to do some epidemiological studies. And one study that was actually quite interesting is that a group of researchers under a group of studies called Calorie, funded by the Obesity Society.
I'll bet it stands for something, but...
So actually what they found is, in fact, any combination of low-calorie diets and exercise actually will lead to the same effect as or calories restrictions.
Uh-huh.
So it's not really clear whether or not just calorie restriction itself is important or there's some added benefit from eating moderately less and exercising as well.
Right.
So again, this just adds to the growing question of exactly what is this calorie restriction doing?
So secret long life?
Eat right and exercise more, which I think they've been saying for years.
Right. Or eat substantially less, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't give up at all just yet. And this was actually published in a recent edition of Science Now.
And that's all for our look at current developments in the world of science and technology this week. This is Berkeley Groxel listening to here on 90.7 FM. In a few moments, Mr. Leander Caney joins us to talk about the cult of the iPod. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Berkeley Grogs. Well, it's that time of the year again. That's right, it's the week of Macworld, and this week there are many exciting developments happening in the world of Apple Computer and technology in general. Well, joining us today is Mr. Leander Caney, editor of Wired News. He's the author of The Cult of the Mac, and recently just came out with a follow-up, The Cult of the iPod. Mr. Caney, thanks for joining us today on Berkeley Grogs.
You're welcome, Frank.
This new book you have, The Cult of the iPod, is it a follow-up on the your previous one?
Indeed, yeah, it is. And it was initially going to be just a chapter in the second edition of Cult of Mac, but there was so much to write about with the iPod and iPod culture that it became obvious that it wanted a book of its own.
You know, thumbing through your book, I noticed there's a lot of anecdotes and stories. Did you compile themselves, or did you have readers send them to you?
Oh, a lot of it was original reporting that I did for Wired News. So I was watching the iPod take off and did a lot of stories in the early days of the iPod about its impact on listening habits and music culture. This is, you know, when it was there was this, when the iPod was restricted to a fairly small club of you know, mainly Mac users, and then when, you know, it went mainstream, and this is sort of when I put together the book, just when that was beginning to happen, you know, like about a year ago now. So there was a lot of stories about that, you know, and it really has taken off in this past year. So the book is a lot about, you know, it's the way it's changing listening habits, you know, the way that things like random shuffle or the playlist is now the sort of the main unit, listening unit, rather than, you know, it used to be the single, then the LP, then the CD. Now it's all about the playlist. And the consequences of that, you know, things like playlistism, how people manage their music collections so that other people who look at them over the network, you know, can't make value judgments about the kind of music they like. So it was, you know, it's looking at sort of digital music culture and how the iPod is defining it. And that's really sort of taken off in the last year or so. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about it that music's going digital. I mean, we're buying it online. We're listening to it on our computers. The computer has taken over the stereo in the living room, you know, as the source of music. Or in fact, well, the iPod has, really. So it's a snapshot of the sort of, you know, how the iPod has really taken digital music by the horns and is defining it.
What were some of the more interesting stories you came across with the iPod?
I guess, you know, iPod jacking was a little bit unusual. I was kind of surprised by that. When people share their iPod jacks to listen to each other's music. And this is sort of something that happened because of the white headphones. You know, it made it so distinctive. People would recognize, you know, another iPod user. And again, especially in the early days, it the white headphones meant you were a part of a special club. And it was probably pretty likely that you had something in common with somebody, and you know, even another stranger you just saw on the street, if they had a pair of white headphones, you probably, it's a good way to break the ice, you know, you could talk to them. So there were some reports of people sharing headphone jacks just to see what, you know, the other person was listening to. Recently I did a story about a kid from Palm Springs, California, who met his girlfriend doing this in a cinema at the local mall. So it's kind of, it's a pretty good way to break the ice to talk to. You know, there's stories about this in New York and on the subway and stuff like that, and but also, you know, to actually discover new music. Although the discovering new music is more like MP3Js, these iPod nights, which seem to have taken off everywhere. It looks like there's an iPod night now in hundreds or thousands even of towns and cities across the world. This is where a pub or a club will let the patrons bring their iPods in and spin tunes for everybody else. And people, you know, take turns. They spend it's starting in New York at this club called APT, and there they have a deli counter where you take a ticket, and then when your number comes up, you get 7 minutes to spin tunes off a couple of iPods that they've laid on for this. But, you know, everywhere's slightly different, and there are places now in London and New York and San Francisco and Philadelphia, and, you know, you name it. I mean, there seems to be these MP3 nights all over the place. And that's really kind of democratized, you know, the whole kind of DJ thing. People are entertaining themselves rather than sort of turning up to listen to the music that the DJ chooses.
Well, the iPod certainly has become an icon. Is this something that Apple had actually planned, or did the iPod just somehow have a life of its own?
Yeah, I think it's totally out of the blue. I don't think anyone, especially not Apple, you know, realized, 4 years ago what they had on their hands. And I think, you know, really, it's been this last year that it's really become this unstoppable juggernaut. And I was just writing a sort of year-end review, looking back at some of the stories that were being written about Apple and the iPod a year ago. It's surprising, but Apple's stock was at its lowest in December 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And people were saying, you know, Apple's got to open up the iPod, otherwise they're going to make the same mistake they made in the PC market, which was, you know, to have a closed proprietary system. You know, and then someone like Microsoft, which has an open, a so-called open system, you know, they license their technology to as many major manufacturers that are interested in using it. The conventional wisdom a year ago was that Apple was going to have to do this with the iPod, open it up to Napster and Real Networks and all its competitors.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they, you know, people, the consumers were going to abandon it, and they wouldn't go for this closed proprietary system any longer. They wanted, you know, something that was open.
Right.
And because it is open, I mean, really, because it's an MP3 player, which even though that's proprietary, you know, it's the sort of de facto standard format that everyone uses to store their music digitally. Anyway, you know, so but now the story is completely different. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago saying that Microsoft is going to have to do this with its Xbox. I mean, and that's exactly what Microsoft has done. I mean, the Xbox supports the iPod. The year has really changed, you know. Apple stock, of course, is double what it used to be, and they're going to sell 11 million iPods this last quarter. Almost every 3 months, they almost double sales. You know, Apple doesn't have to open up anymore to survive. The story has completely changed. I mean, it's other people that have to accommodate Apple these days. You know, that really has been, you know, what happened this last year. The iPod is, no one can doubt it. And they're saying, there was a story as well there just a couple of days ago saying that CES is all about, you know, the iPod. It seems insane, but there's no way anyone would have predicted that a year ago, you know, let alone 4 years ago when the iPod was introduced. It's really surprising because in the past, you know, these technological revolutions have often been picked up by, you know, dozens of companies. So like the Walkman, for example, even though Sony developed it and they sold, you know, 340-odd million, they soon were copied by a whole bunch of cheaper knockoffs. And even though Walkman was, you know, synonymous for portable tape players, you know, Sony, I think, lost the market lead pretty quickly to lower-priced competitors.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't seen that with the iPod at all. And I think, you know, it's an interesting question, why not? Why hasn't anyone been able to replicate it? Why have the other MP3 players, manufacturers, come up with a good alternative? And why hasn't Microsoft, you know, with its Windows Media and its monopoly in desktops, you know, why haven't they been able to unseat Apple? And, you know, I think because, you know, it's a multifaceted product.
Mm-hmm.
The iPod, it's not just a hardware player that you have to rip off. It's the software that feeds it, the digital jukebox in iTunes, plus also the iTunes Music Store. So, you know, they've taken on this whole ecosystem of digital music that's pretty hard, you know, it's pretty hard and complex to replicate.
The iPod originally started as a music player, and recently it gained the capacity to play video. You know, what are some of the more unintended uses that have come about?
What surprised me about it was that people really like it, the iPod video, watching video on an iPod, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The conventional wisdom was that people wouldn't watch video on a tiny screen. But there's been some really interesting reports saying, you know, that I don't have one, unfortunately. My wife won't let me buy one, but how immersive the experience is, you know. And there was an interesting commentary in the New York Times at the weekend, you know, from a guy who uses it during his commute. And he said, you know, he's got three kids and a busy job, and this is his, you know, private time when he's on the bus. And he used to read, but he would get distracted. And now he can plug his earphones in and be totally lost in, of all things Lost, you know, the TV show that he downloads. And so, and it was a really convincing, and he was talking about his experience with the thing and how absorbed he got in it and how much he enjoyed it. And this was something that, I mean, Jobs many times said that they would never do a video iPod because there wasn't the equivalent of a set of headphones for video, you know, and it was something that video was something you had to do to the exclusion of everything else, you know.
Right.
When you sit down to watch a video, you can't be working, you can't be jogging, you can't be doing something else, you know, while you're listening to music. You have to sit down and concentrate on it. And so people were like, you know, I mean, most Americans drive to work, and public transport isn't that popular in this country, you know, and if you're going to be sitting on an airplane, you might as well watch your laptop instead of a, you know, an iPod.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was a lot of skepticism, but it seems, you know, at least for, you know, for a lot of people, that there is room for this this media experience. That was kind of surprising to me because, excuse me, I was skeptical too.
Mm-hmm.
That's another reason I don't have the video iPod. You know, I really don't have anywhere to use it, to watch it, you know.
And
either sit in front of a computer all day, or if I go home, I can watch TV.
Uh-huh.
So, that's still probably true, I think, for probably a large part of people. And that was what was clever about Apple. This is primarily a music device that also does video. So it's an ancillary function, you know, it's an extra.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't marketed it as a video watching device, you know,
right.
which I don't think would be as compelling to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Frank. Thank you for having me.
And we were just talking to Mr. Leander Caney from Wired News. His new book, The Cult of the iPod, is now available online and bookstores around the country. This is Berkeley Groff, you're listening to Here on 90.7 FM. Coming up, we'll find out what the DeBroy wavelength plus the Barakatron 5000, so stay tuned. Berkeley Groks. Well, Mr. Caney has kindly agreed to join us on this week's edition of the Grokotron 5000, the computer formerly known as Deep Blue. And today's topic is wired or unwired. And here are five subjects. Subject number one, Oprah Winfrey, wired or unwired?
Unwired. I don't watch her, so I don't really know. I mean, maybe she is wired. You know, I don't know anything about her, really. I don't even know if she's like, I guess she's popular, right? You know, the only thing I saw her on was, I didn't see Letterman, I just saw reports about it, but that was the biggest buzz I saw about Oprah this year. So I guess maybe she's wired, because she went back on Letterman.
All right, subject number two, Microsoft honcho Bill Gates, wired or unwired?
I guess he's wired, he's got to be wired. Time, man of the year, he's got a knighthood, and he's given away a ton of cash. Unlike Steve Jobs,
uh-huh.
who, as far as I know, doesn't give anything away.
Subject number three, Linux, wired or unwired?
I think Linux is unwired. I haven't heard a lot of buzz about Linux this year, except maybe Ubuntu Linux, but, you know, it's really seems to have dropped off the map. No one's there's not a lot of buzz about Linux, although I'm sure it's doing very well. But there was, you know, at one time a lot of hype about Linux on the desktop, and That lasted for a number of years, but that definitely dropped off last year. No one's really talking about that any longer.
All right. I guess the answer might be obvious for this one. Wired or unwired, Apple designer Jonathan Ives?
Oh, wired, for sure. Yeah, he's gone from strength to strength. He's like, he was voted the most influential Brit by some big poll in the UK. He beat out Richard Branson and Tony Blair. No, he beat them all out. He's probably the most famous designer in the world, I think. Or one of them, anyway. So, yeah, he's definitely wired.
Okay, and finally, our perennial favorite, wired or unwired, the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
I guess I'm in safe ground, Berkeley, right? So, yeah, definitely unwired. I mean, he's the worst president ever, as a New Yorker likes to say.
He does have an iPod, you know.
Oh, well, yeah, but he didn't. What did he say? That he shuffles the shuffle, or something? He bungled that. I mean, it's unbelievable how he's such a bumbling idiot. But, I mean, he's evil, too. I mean, he is probably. And look at the people he's surrounded with, Rumsfeld and Cheney. They look like Hollywood villains.
Yeah, what's on their playlist?
Well, evil stuff. I mean, those guys are, you know, going straight to hell, without doubt. Incredible, you know, spying on their own citizens. It just, you know, the latest news that he, you know, they that they that they told the NSA to spy on Americans. I mean, it's a dictatorship. I mean, they are above the law. The law makes no, you know, has no, they're not bounded by it. It makes no difference what happens. I mean, it's like they're going to go down in history as worse than Nixon. I mean, there's unbelievable band of crooks and incompetence ever. It's astonishing. Absolutely amazing.
All right, thanks a lot for joining us on this week's Grokotron 5000.
Welcome, Frank. Thanks so much.
And for us here with the answer to last week's question of the week, what's the De Broglie wavelength? Well, the De Broglie wavelength is the correspondent wavelength of a particle, and that's the De Broglie wavelength.
All right, well, we're back and have a very special guest in the studio who's going to give this week's question of the week.
Yeah, isn't he like the science ambassador from Kenya or something?
We have our science ambassador from Kenya, Jason Kenya.
Oh, it's a pleasure to meet you, to meet everybody here. But for me, my question would be, I would like to find out what is peak oil?
So if you know the answer to this question, you can email us at grox@hotmail.com.
Oh, but you won't win anything, sorry to say so, but it's an educational thing. Don't worry about it.
Indeed.
And that's all for this week's edition of Berkeley Grox.
Make sure you tune in next week for more from the world of science and technology.
If you'd like to contact us here at Berkeley Grox, you can email us at grox@hotmail.com. For Berkeley Grox, I'm Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee. Make sure you also see us on the web at www.grox.net. Have a great afternoon and stay tuned for more music.